Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, Thursday, June 29th. It's approximately 8:35 in the morning. I'll note for the people on the internet who may be listening that one reason we're in confusion this morning is we've moved, and it's a cozy room, going to be a cozy hearing room today. At the close of yesterday's session, we had concluded staff's testimony, and we had some housekeeping issues related to the applicant's filing of PowerPoint presentations as exhibits in the case. And did the parties want to deal with that first and get that out of the way so we don't forget before joint interveners begin?
Mr. Smith, I had the exhibits marked, I believe, at the end of the day, and so they are marked as exhibits, and I believed I moved those into evidence yesterday at the conclusion of the hearing.
Did we? Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you. Mr. O'Neill, are you the man of the hour?
Good morning, Mr. Smith. Yes. What I can do here this morning is identify the exhibits that the joint interveners intend on introducing today. So we have a number for each of them, and then when the witness comes up, we will formally introduce them. Does that sound like a plan?
That sounds like a plan, yep.
Joint interveners exhibit number one is the direct testimony of David Schlissel and Anna Summer, Synapse Energy Economics Incorporated, on behalf of the joint interveners. It does have the exhibits attached to them, exhibit 1A through 1H. Joint interveners exhibit number two is the direct testimony of Ezra Hausman, PhD, Synapse Energy Economics Incorporated, from May 19, 2006. Joint interveners exhibit number three is the direct testimony of Marshall Goldberg of MRG and Associates Incorporated. Joint interveners exhibit number four is the direct testimony of David A. Schlissel and Anna Summer, Synapse Energy Economics. This is the confidential version from May 26, 2006. There is also a public version that we've also labeled Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 4 of the same May 26th testimony. Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 5 is the rebuttal testimony of David A. Schlissel and Anna Summer, Synapse Energy Economics Incorporated, dated June 9th, 2006. Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 6 is the surrebuttal testimony of David A. Schlissel and Anna Summer, Synapse Energy Economics Incorporated, and that's dated June 22, 2006. And lastly, Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 7 that we will be introducing today is the surrebuttal testimony of Ezra Hausman, PhD, Synapse Energy Economics Incorporated, dated June 20, 2006.
Thank you. Are any of these going to be moved into evidence other than via a live witness?
Yes. Before the testimony here today, we reached an agreement with the applicants, and I believe, Ms. Stevie, that there would not be any cross-examination of Ezra Hausman. Mr. Hausman is the expert that we had prepared testimony regarding the issue of the CO2 or greenhouse gas effect as a result of the coal. And we're introducing his direct testimony as Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 2, and that's from May 19, 2006, as well as his surrebuttal testimony, joint intervener's exhibit number 7 from June 20th, 2006. And at this time, we would move to introduce into evidence joint intervener's exhibit number 2 and 7.
And do the parties agree that the introduction has been stipulated?
We agree. We assume that you will file an affidavit similarly to what, how we have filed, that he would affirm under oath that testimony. So that the record is clear that he provided that testimony under oath. But and we can reserve a number if you want to reserve your number 8. Is that your last? Was it 8?
We could possibly do a 7A if that would be okay.
Whatever number you'd like.
7A, we will reserve for the affidavit of Ezra Hausman.
Okay. And if there's no objection, I'm going to, you have offered, can you offer that now? And I'm going to say we'll just receive that into evidence when it comes here.
Sure.
Okay.
We will offer into evidence exhibit number, joint intervener's exhibit number 7A, which will be the affidavit of Ezra Hausman swearing to the direct and surrebuttal testimony.
And we'll have no objection.
I have
one question. Yes, ma'am. Ms. Stevie.
I do have a question as far as did the... Did the testimony include reference to the CO2 emission chart?
The CO2 emission chart?
For Big Stone 2 supplied to the South Dakota. May I move for admission?
Move for what?
The testimony...
Are you talking about Mr. Hausman?
Mr. Hausman's testimony.
I'm unsure. I would have to look through the testimony to make sure. I don't know what chart you're talking about.
Can we?
Can I move for judicial
notice of that?
Judicial notice.
No. Why don't we get? We'll get to the bottom of this, and we'll deal with that after they have put on their case or at some time here. Is that okay?
That's okay.
Then we'll find out. If it was something that was in one of their exhibits, it's highly likely that it will come in as a part of today's activities. But let's just check.
Okay.
And it may end up in the record. Please proceed, Mr. O'Neill.
With that, Mr. Smith, we would call as our first witness this morning, Marshall Goldberg.
Good morning.
Sir, do you want to raise your right hand?
Yep.
You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in this cause will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Goldberg.
Good morning.
Mr. Goldberg, for purposes of the record, can you state your full name?
My name is Marshall R. Goldberg.
And for purposes of background, can you tell us a little bit about your educational background?
Sure. I have a master's degree in community and regional planning from the University of Oregon.
For purposes of work-related background, can you provide us a little bit of your work-related background as it relates to your testimony here today?
Sure. I have my own consulting firm, MRG and Associates, and I've been practicing for about 15 years doing energy and economic resource analysis. I've been working primarily for state economic development commissions, departments, state energy offices, U.S. Department of Energy, number of different think tank type groups, Union of Concerned Scientists, American Council for Energy Efficient Economy, quite a few groups that are involved in energy planning and analysis.
For this case here today, did you cause to be prepared pre-filed direct testimony?
Yes, I did.
And can you look at exhibit number 3. Is that your pre-filed direct testimony that you caused to be prepared in this case?
Yes, it is. Looks like it.
If I asked you the same questions contained within Exhibit 3, would your answers be the same?
Yes, they would.
Are there any changes or corrections to your testimony?
No.
We would offer into evidence Exhibit number 3.
No objection by the applicants.
Joint Intervenors, Exhibit 3 is received into evidence.
Mr. Goldberg, can you prepare or can you provide us a brief summary of your testimony that you filed in this case here this morning?
Yes, I can, certainly. During the last several years, I've been doing quite a bit of work for the Department of Energy National Renewable Energy Laboratory, doing an economic impact analysis, building some models for them to allow them to document and address economic benefits related to different energy technologies. And most recently, I worked on one for wind-related development. And I, as part of that, the Wind Technology Center, who I'm working with, has several states that they've asked me to do analysis for, and one of those states was South Dakota. And I recently completed an analysis of an equivalent generation using wind compared to a 600-megawatt coal-fired power plant. And based on that analysis, I was asked to detail the impacts that might occur, the economic impacts that might occur from constructing and developing wind generation resources in the area of South Dakota. I found that there were significant economic impacts both in the construction as well as the O&M, the ongoing 20 to 30-year time frame which the plant would be operating. I found that those impacts were diverse. They would be across the whole state depending on where wind plants were generated, significant long-term impacts. I found that when comparing this to coal-fired power plant, well, actually in the analysis that I did for National Renewable Energy Laboratories, I did not compare it to a coal-fired power plant. I didn't do the analysis for a coal-fired power plant. It was strictly for a wind plant if wind technology were put in place. My analysis was based on 1,320 megawatts of wind resource that would be put in to provide equivalent electricity generation to a 600-megawatt wind plant. I found that significant economic opportunities would be provided by putting in wind power. I also found in my testimony the other component was I was asked to look at the economic impact analysis that was done for the Big Stone 2 plant and to provide some comparisons to the analysis that I had done for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. And consistent with what I just said, I found that the benefits from wind were significantly greater. They were comparable in terms of the construction period, assuming a 4-year construction period for the coal plant and assuming a similar construction period for the wind resource. On the construction level, they're very similar. On the O&M, the ongoing, the long-term economic impacts, I found that they were significantly greater. I also found that the benefits that I estimated for wind would actually be all within the state of South Dakota, whereas I recognized the benefits that Mr. Stufen analyzed were actually split between South Dakota and Minnesota, and in fact, at least in my mind, there was some inconsistencies in the assumptions that he used for how even that much, the 50% that he noted, would actually be put in place in South Dakota. So there's certainly some inconsistencies there. But either way, regardless of what number was used, I found that the wind benefits were significantly greater. I found that if this commission, if the state of South Dakota finds that energy diversity and opportunities for economic development are a prime concern as we increase generation resources, that wind should certainly be considered. Another point in my testimony that I think is worth noting is that based on experiences other places, I have seen that enhancing generation resources, bringing a wind industry into a state, has that added benefit of encouraging additional economic development. The opportunity is significant for manufacturers to move into the area and actually bring more jobs and more economic development to the state as a whole. And this is unlike a number of our traditional resources like coal or natural gas, where we don't have manufacturing industries offering to move to states to enhance, to build up, to ramp up in response to these kind of decisions. We are finding that with wind. So.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. We would now tender Mr. Goldberg for cross-examination.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Goldberg. I don't think we've met before. My name's Tom Welk. Mr. Goldberg, the only point of your testimony this morning, as I understand it, is if there was a hypothetical wind farm with 1320 megawatts constructed here in South Dakota, there would be more economic benefits to the state of South Dakota rather than the proposed coal-fired plant for Big Stone. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's, in essence, your entire testimony, correct?
Well, my testimony is that, and it also relates to the analysis that was completed by Randall Stufen.
But that is what you're telling this commission. If this hypothetical wind farm was constructed in South Dakota, there'd be more economic benefits to the state than the coal-fired plant.
Yes.
Where do you assume this hypothetical wind farm is going to be constructed in South Dakota?
Well, it wasn't part of my analysis to assume where they would be, but when I was directed by National Renewable Energy Laboratory to do this analysis, it was not related to Big Stone. It was related to the fact that there are a number of states that the wind technology program is focusing on that have a significant wind resource and potential for significant economic development.
So you don't have in your hypothetical, we don't know where this wind farm is going to be in South Dakota?
We don't know specifically, but we do know that South Dakota has one of the best wind resources in the whole country.
Well, you base this conclusion on a fact that there would be more long-term jobs in the wind plant than the coal-fired plant, correct?
Yes, sir.
That's the principal tenet of your analysis, that you're going to have in this hypothetical wind farm 172 jobs in the wind plant, and there'll be somewhere around 30 of the coal-fired plant that would be permanent jobs. Is that correct?
I didn't make the determination it'd be 30. That was the analysis that I reviewed. And the 172 that I've estimated is actually jobs that would be across the state, depending on where the wind plant. So this isn't just one centralized wind plant, so it would benefit residents all over the state.
But the jobs that you in your hypothetical are $8 an hour jobs at the wind plant. Is that correct?
No, they're probably more on the order of $13 to $15 an hour jobs, some of them even higher, depending on whether there were field technicians going out in the field or whether there were administrative jobs or whether they were project manager jobs.
Is your 15, does that include the base rate plus benefits? How are your $15 an hour worth?
Well, I've just given you sort of a off-the-cuff 15. Some of them might be $18 an hour jobs. There's a variation.
Well, let's look at your Exhibit 3 and go to your appendix. And the after your resume and your list of literature continues, you have put your model in the appendix of Exhibit 3. Is that correct?
Put the results of that run for NREL that was done. Yes.
And NREL, that's just an acronym for the computer model you were using?
No. NREL is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, U.S. Department of Energy. JEDI, Jobs and Economic Development, is the NREL model.
So it was a computer model that you ran to create these numbers?
Yes.
And in this computer model, on the page that I'm on here, where it says local economic impact summary of results, and then during operating years annual, you've got a listing there, direct impacts, plant workers only, $7.96.
$7.96 million.
Yeah, and how much, and so tell me then, how much do you anticipate in this hypothetical wind farm? We don't know where it's going to be. How much somebody's going to get paid for working at the wind farm?
Okay, once again, if they're a field technician out in the field, they could be making $15 an hour.
Now, one of the things I was interested in is, in your analysis, you assume that the wind plant would pay local property taxes of $2 million for the life of the plant for 20 to 30 years, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you, but in looking and comparing Sync to Big Stone, you assumed that Big Stone would pay $4.7 million in real property taxes for 10 years, correct?
I didn't make that assumption. I used that data was in the reports that I was provided. Can't remember the
Fennell Johnson.
Fennell Johnson, and it said in there that that was her estimate, and for 10 years it said. I took it directly from the report.
But you didn't, when you compared the economic benefits to the state, you didn't consider the real property taxes after 10 years for the coal-fired plant, did you?
No, sir.
Did you think that the coal-fired plant's not going to pay real estate taxes after 10 years?
I would assume they probably did. I took that directly from her testimony. It said for 10 years.
But, I mean, when you did your analysis, didn't you stop and think, well, the coal plant's going to be there for 30 to 40 years? Aren't they going to be paying local property taxes at $5 million a year for more than 10 years?
I didn't do any analysis of that. I just noted that number in comparison to what I had estimated for wind. I didn't analyze the coal plant. I do know that there are states where there are tax incentives and deals that are cut to bring that kind of development to the area.
Well, Mr. Goldberg, we're not talking about other states. We're talking about the state of South Dakota. What county is the coal-fired plant going to be located in?
Big Stone is in, is it Grant County?
Yeah. And what's the county seat of Grant County?
I don't remember. I don't know.
So you didn't call the local office to find out about real property taxes where this coal-fired plant's going to be located?
As I stated before, when I did my analysis, I didn't analyze the coal-fired power plant. I took the analysis that your witness provided.
Yeah, but you didn't even think about putting in another 10 years of real estate taxes?
I didn't see any reason. It wasn't part of my analysis. I didn't analyze the coal plant. It took exactly what was analyzed and took that information.
Well, how did you come up with $2 million in property taxes for the wind farm? Where did you get that number?
Information came from a resource from this commission based on $1,600 per megawatt.
Did you call any of the counties in the state of South Dakota to figure out what the real number would be rather than just assume some number?
For wind?
Yes.
Larry Flowers, the director of the wind project at Department of Energy, he made that call. And he gave me that number.
But you didn't make a single phone call to anybody in South Dakota to try to figure out what the real number was?
I assume that was the real number. It came from a commission.
When you looked at your analysis, did you look at the additional cost to generate electricity for consumers arising from a wind plant?
No, that wasn't part of my analysis for NREL.
You didn't consider any of the cost of the transmission of the wind, did you?
No, it wasn't part of the analysis.
You did not consider that wind cannot generate ancillary services, did you?
As I said, it wasn't part of my analysis. My analysis was to analyze what the economic benefits would be for a comparable electricity generation for wind compared with coal.
The purpose of your analysis was not to determine how much of either coal or wind was dispatchable, was it?
No, it was not.
And your analysis did not analyze a map accreditation and load capability for the purposes of comparing wind and coal-fired generation?
No, sir. I've done this analysis for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory for several states, and the U.S. Department of Energy, NREL, doesn't do project-specific analysis.
But we're here for a project, sir.
Yes, sir.
We're not here for something in some other state. We're here for a particular project. You understand that?
Certainly.
You have not taken a position in your analysis whether the applicant should propose or build this hypothetical wind farm compared to the proposed Big Stone 2 plant, have you?
No, sir.
And you haven't analyzed whether this hypothetical wind farm or the proposed Big Stone 2 unit was the least cost alternative. That was not your purpose of your testimony.
No, it was not. My analysis was to look at what would the economic benefits would be if wind were put in.
And you did no analysis to see if there were going to be any increases in rates to consumers of electricity if this hypothetical wind farm was constructed, correct?
No, I didn't do that for wind or for coal.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Housekeeping matter. Mr. O'Neill, did you intend to offer your exhibit?
Sure. The testimony?
Yes, Exhibit 3.
Yes. At this time, we would offer joint intervenors Exhibit Number 3 with the exhibits to that exhibit.
No objection.
Stevie? Joint intervenors Exhibit 3 with attachment is received into evidence. Ms. Stevie?
No questions.
Staff?
Good morning.
Good morning.
When you looked at placing the wind turbines, did you have an idea of how many acres of land that would be affected?
No, I didn't actually look at placing the wind turbines. My role is economic impact analysis. I was looking at the number of megawatts that could potentially be installed in South Dakota relative to this size plant.
Okay. Do you know what I'm talking about when I refer to the Weston 4 plant in Wisconsin?
No, I don't. No.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that all staff has?
Yes.
Okay. A redirect? Oh, excuse me. I forgot again. Commissioner questions. The problem is you guys are sitting beside me instead of in front of me.
Your excuses are amusing, Mr. Smith, but not compelling. Did you have an opportunity to review the testimony of Mr. Klein?
No, I'm not familiar with that name.
Okay. I don't have any other questions, Mr. Smith. Thanks.
No, applicant or intervener's redirect. Oh, you do. Okay, sorry.
Out of sight, out of mind.
That's right. It's worse today, too, because you're way over there.
Mr. Goldberg, you had said you obtained information from Larry Flowers.
Yes.
Would you tell us again what his position is and level of credibility?
Sure. Larry Flowers is one of the directors for the National Wind Technology Program at the U.S. Department of Energy, NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory Facility in Golden, Colorado. And he heads up the program that contract with me to develop the models and to work on the economic impact analysis for a number of priority states. In terms of his credibility, I'm not sure what to say. He's a pretty credible guy. he's thought of very highly in the wind industry, and his focus, in addition to working on enhancing energy resources, is looking at economic development opportunities around the country and how wind can provide those kind of benefits for various states, counties, local areas.
Thank you.
I will vouch for Larry Flowers' credibility, although he has gotten me into a little bit of trouble because he tells me things that I cannot verify. So, for instance, he told me a while back that based on the new wind maps, South Dakota was clearly number one in the nation, and I told that to a reporter at the Argus Leader who was unable to independently verify that. So Larry's very credible, but he has gotten me into a little bit of trouble here and there. Just a quick question on your analysis. When you're comparing the issue of coal plants and wind power, or at least looking at the benefits of wind. Certainly, you know, one of the issues that has come up over the past several days is the difference between firm and non-firm power.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment a little bit on our arena situation where, you know, I think while we have a lot of interest in seeing wind power resources developed here in our state, is this an apples to oranges comparison if we're talking about a firm versus non-firm source? Because my understanding is if you look across the state, tremendous potential, and we've got some capacity factors at current wind farms that are in the high 40s. Still, though, when you compare that to a power plant that's going to be operating, you know, probably if close to double that capacity factor, or maybe a little less, are we in an apples or oranges comparison, or do you just strictly look at the economic impact?
Okay, my main focus is economic impact, but I certainly get involved in these kinds of conversations. And I think, rather than call it apples to oranges, I think it's more, more realistic to call it apples to apples, where maybe it's, Gravenstein to Pippins or something like that. I think they're both, energy resources. I think, in my opinion anyway, all resources have their constraints and aren't operating 100% of the time. We can't necessarily count on every resource. Certainly there's some that have a higher capacity factor than others. But what I understand is when we develop and we construct and operate such a large, diverse offering of wind in many different areas, that we're in a situation where we're going to have wind operating all the time, and not just either all 40% of the time and 40 and zero. I think we're going to have a diversity depending on where they're operated. So I think the reliability is less of a factor than we have traditionally thought it was going to be.
In a follow-up or a second question along those same lines, now, I have had conversations and spent some substantial time at NREL meeting with them, and I know the concept is out there that the wind is always blowing somewhere sometime, but actually, when they've looked at, this is what I've been told from people at NREL, when you look at weather forecasting and look at the actual data from it, actually there is, there's some real challenges with that theory, because across a region it tends to either be fairly windy, all at the same time, or the system comes through a region, and then when it's calm, it's very calm for an extended period of time. If you can kind of follow my drift.
Sure.
And so when you're talking about, and I find it fascinating, because I think there is a lot of merit to talking about dispersed wind farms and overall looking at trying to deal with some of the intermittency problems through weather forecasting and to taking advantage of the wind blowing somewhere when it's not blowing somewhere. So I agree and have interest in your theory. But in practice, I mean, if we're looking at North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota, let's just say those three states, I mean, typically with the way the weather systems move through, I mean, if the wind isn't blowing in southern North Dakota, it's probably not blowing in northern South Dakota. Is that correct, or do you have any experience with that?
I don't have experience in that level of detail, but I will say that in terms of the analysis that I did and done, it wasn't based on understanding whether there was actually even base load need or capacity need here. So the degree that you're going to is something that I wasn't really involved in. But there may be some different analysis if there had been some evidence to suggest that there was really a base load need. So I don't know the answer to that.
And my next question may be along the same lines, and I appreciate you going somewhat outside the scope of your testimony when I ask these questions. We're dealing with, on the scope of things, and with all due deference to them, they're to the interested partners in the plant, they are relatively small utilities in terms of comparing them to national scope. And in terms of numbers of either customers or members, the concept of taking on 600, 1300, whatever the number you want to pick, megawatts of wind, I mean, did you evaluate the feasibility of that from an energy mix standpoint? Because certainly I believe that, I'll say the rule of thumb out there and is somewhere between 10 and 20% seems to be a reasonable number. And if you talk to most of the more diehard utility people, they'll say, well, we can take on about 10% of our energy mix from wind, maybe. You talk to some of the wind people, they'll try to push it up to 20, but there aren't too many people that I know out there that go kind of beyond those brackets, at least that I have had the experience meeting, and I've talked to hundreds of people in the wind industry about that. I mean, the concept of a 1,320 mega wind farm, I think we'd all love to see that happen in the state, but if it's displacing a baseload coal plant, aren't we in a situation where, because of the relatively small loads of these utilities who are partners in this plant, that they're going to have some difficulties dealing with that from an integration standpoint?
It's not my area of expertise in terms of integration, but once again, I don't know the answer to whether it's displacing a baseload capacity plant. I have not seen anything or read anything in the analysis I was given that suggests that that what's before you is for a baseload plant, or that it's, that there's evidence that it's needed. I should say that. And then the other thing, in your reference, a 1,320 megawatt wind plant. Once again, my analysis doesn't make the assumption, for one, that the owners of Big Stone would actually, they would be the people putting in that wind plant. I wasn't suggesting that necessarily. They certainly could propose that. I understand that they wanted to propose some, although I didn't see anything firm on that. And the other thing that I think is important to recognize is that it's not one big centralized plant. I mean, certainly somebody could put in a large, you know, wind plant, but I think more realistically what we're looking at is diversity and potentially being put in quite a few different areas.
And then back more to the economic analysis, did you look to any of the issues that would be involved with the fact that with wind you're going to have a capacity factor of 40-something percent perhaps, and that the utilities would have to go out then on the open market, buy replacement electricity, possibly fired, very, very likely from natural gas-fired turbines, and look at the economic impacts of one, those purchases, and two, the regional impact from a regional and national pricing standpoint on increasing the cost of natural gas throughout the region and country because of increased purchases?
I didn't look at that aspect. I understand some of the other witnesses for the joint interveners did actually look at some combinations, gas-wind combinations. But I think the point there that relates to my doing this economic impact analysis and what I think for a lot of commissions in areas around the country is that one of the benefits of wind is to help insulate us from price shocks and the issues that relate to petroleum prices that we've seen recently. And the benefits of wind, obviously, are there aren't any fuels. If gasoline goes up, the price of wind isn't going to go up. If coal goes up or natural gas costs go up, then the cost to consumers are going to go up as well.
One of the challenges that we have in South Dakota is that we are on the far end of the eastern transmission grid, and there are limited spots in the state where there are adequate injection points because of a variety of issues, seams issues, pricing issues, so on and so forth. We have, you know, the ability to put on a few hundred megawatts of wind relatively easily in the scope of things. With some transmission upgrades, we might be able to go higher than that. But for large-scale wind development to happen in this region, we have a situation where we will need quite a bit of new transmission to be built. Did you, in your analysis of a hypothetical wind farm, does that include the pricing necessary to pay for that transmission system? Because, you know, right now, I don't think you could put a wind farm of that size onto the grid. So I was curious, you know, who pays for that upgrade?
that wasn't part of my analysis. But I do understand that the analysis for Big Stone didn't include that either. And in fact, I think, as I understand, I'm going to be looking at significant transmission upgrades if the Big Stone 2 goes in as well. So it wasn't part of my analysis.
Okay, thank you. And that was my next question was, with the proposed coal plant or the expansion to Big Stone 1 with Big Stone 2, they are discussing building additional capacity onto those power lines to allow, you know, we don't know who would build it, we don't know where it would be built, but to give the opportunity within the region to have several hundred or more megawatts of wind be able to, or other renewables being placed onto those lines. Mm-hmm. Does that not give us the opportunity to really get both benefits of bringing on a baseload plant and having the ability for, you know, some incremental costs that they are willing to shoulder to give us the opportunity then to add several hundred or more megawatts of wind farm? Is that not a scenario that really benefits both the needs of the consumers and the future potential for getting wind power onto our grid in the system?
I think certainly on the surface it appears that that capability would be there and the opportunity, but I think in reality, and once again this isn't part of my analysis, but my understanding is that if you were to approve and a 600 megawatt coal plant would be built, that there would not be much incentive or need for anybody to do that. So while the opportunity might be there in terms of the distribution, the transmission distribution, I think the reality is that we wouldn't build the wind, wouldn't happen.
Thank you.
Not on the scale you're talking about.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Smith, just as a point of clarification, when I was asking a question pertaining to Larry Flowers, and I suspect he never thought that his name was going to be used nearly so much at this meeting. I am a member on the board with the National Wind Coordinating Committee, and I work with Larry and have been associated with him for several years now. So I know him very well, but I just felt that there should be something introduced into the record since you said you obtained the information from him.
Yeah.
Redirect.
Yep, just one area. Mr. Flowers' name will come up one more time. the representation that South Dakota was possibly the number one state, or in your testimony that South Dakota was a priority state, can you just give us the information that you have that would suggest South Dakota being a priority state for wind and what the National Energy Lab uses to try and foster that that goal of it being a priority?
Okay, first off, in terms of where it stands in being one of the top states, I think the wind maps are actually on the web. I don't have the location with me, but I think in terms of whether the newspaper needed that information, in terms of the wind resource around the country, I think National Renewable Energy Laboratory publishes those on the web, so anybody can go there and see which states are the top. In terms of priority, I preface my remarks by saying that isn't what I'm doing for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in terms of determining which are the priority states. But as I understand, the priority states are the ones with the highest wind resource and the ability to bring those kind of plants online. And what NREL is doing through analysis that I'm doing, building these models and doing other kinds of efforts in terms of the enhancing the kinds of generation resource that will be available to utilities and other developers, is providing tools and information so that commissions like this can look at other benefits of wind rather than limit it to just, we need some electricity generation, because as you and most commissions know, economic impact and opportunities are a key component. And if that is one of your objectives, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory is trying to provide information to help you understand how it can really benefit the state and provide other opportunities that aren't limited to wind, but provide what you need in terms of energy as well.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
I don't have anything further.
Did you have a question, Ms. Stevie? You're excused, Mr. Goldberg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, all caps.
You may call your next witness.
As our next witness, we would call David Schlissel. We are in the process of trying to get copies of the PowerPoint presentation. I don't know where that sits.
Do you need a 5-minute break to get organized?
That might be a good idea.
Okay. Yep.
What? Yeah. That's what I need advice on.
Yes, they need to swap reports.
For the folks on the internet, we are taking a 5-minute recess. articles on the internet. We are finishing up a few technical issues and should be back in session momentarily.
Call as our next witness, David Schlissel.
I just want to raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony about giving this cause will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Good morning, Mr. Schlissel.
Good morning.
Mr. Schlissel, can you please state your full name for the record?
David Allen, A-L-A-N, Schlissel, S-C-H-L-I-S-S-E-L.
For purposes of background, can you provide us your educational background?
I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Astronautical Engineering from MIT, a Master's degree in the same subject from Stanford University. I have a Juris Doctor degree from Stanford University School of Law, and I've also studied Nuclear Engineering and Project Management at MIT, but not in a degree program.
Can you please provide us your work-related experience that is relevant to your testimony here today?
I've been working on energy and environmental issues for over 32 years. The first five or six were as an attorney. Since then, I've been a consultant on technical and economic studies on a wide variety of issues, including examining utilities' need for new capacity, how utility systems operate, load forecasts, wide range of issue, power plant operations and costs.
Thank you. In this case, did you cause to be prepared direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony?
Yes, jointly with Ms. Anna Summer, who also works with me at Synapse.
And if you look at the documents in front of you, Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 1, is that the direct testimony of you and Ms. Summer?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions or corrections to that testimony?
Ms. Summers has a couple of typos in the exhibits to this testimony. I don't know if you want me to do them now or to wait till she is in the witness chair.
What we'd like to do, I guess, is at some point, and I'd like to do it when we're done talking here this morning, introducing it as an exhibit, but maybe we can leave, for purposes of the record, any corrections that Ms. Summer would make. Does that sound fair?
That sounds fair. I can tell you, as we go through some of the pieces of testimony, I found a couple of typos, but her list is different than mine.
Do you want to identify those for us right now?
In Joint Interveners Exhibit 1, there are no typos
okay.
that I found.
All right. If I asked you the questions that are contained in Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 1, would your, and to the best of your knowledge, Ms. Summers, answer to those questions be the same?
Yes.
This time we would move into evidence Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 1.
Are there is there an objection?
Perhaps since Ms. Summer maybe is jointly prepared this exhibit and maybe testifying about it, perhaps we should just wait until we have her also.
Before we move it into evidence?
Before you move it into evidence. And
directing your attention to Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 4, do you have that document in front of you?
Yes.
And that contains both the confidential version and the public version of your rebuttal testimony. Is that true? Or I don't believe that is rebuttal. That's further direct testimony. Is that right?
That's correct.
And if I asked you the questions contained on Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 4, May 26, 2006, would your answers be the same?
Yes, except I'd clean up two typos.
And what are those?
On page 8, line 7. In the question, the word that, T-H-A-T, should be inserted between the word analyses and were, so that the question would read, what are the three jointly sponsored analyses that were submitted as part of the co-owner's testimony in this proceeding?
Okay. Anywhere else?
Yes. The next typo is on page 34, line 10. The words has not at the beginning of the line should be eliminated. Deleted, so that the beginning of the sentence would read, nor has it evaluated.
Okay.
But those are the typos I found in Joint Interveners Exhibit 4.
Directing your attention to the rebuttal testimony, Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 5, prepared on June 9th, 2006. Do you have that testimony in front of you? Yes. Again, if I asked you the questions contained in Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 5, would your answers be the same today?
Yes.
Are there any changes or corrections to that?
None that I've found.
Directing your attention to Joint Interveners Exhibit Number 6, the surrebuttal testimony filed on June 22, 2006. Do you have that document in front of you?
Yes.
If I asked you the questions contained in that surrebuttal testimony, would your answers be the same today?
Yes, subject to correcting four typos.
Okay. Let's go to those four typos.
Page 4, line 24. The word in the middle of the line, it currently reads is, I-S. It should be in, I-N. So it would, the line would read, permit capacity to be added to a system in smaller increments or demand side. The next is page 12, line 24. The fourth word from the end of the line, displaced, should be displace. The D at the end of the word should be eliminated. Page 16, line 3. The word his, H-I-S, should be inserted in front of rebuttal so that the first sentence of the question would read, Mr. Grieg has testified that the figures in Table 1 in his rebuttal testimony. Then finally, on page 23, in Table 1, I can't read in Ms. Summers' handwriting. I'll let her deal with that one. I apologize for taking you to the spot. I don't want to make a typo on top of a typo.
And finally, you've prepared a summary exhibit for your testimony here today. Is that true?
Yes, it is.
That's Exhibit 15?
Yes.
Can you provide us that summary testimony?
Sure. In their planning, what we've found in our investigation, please tell me, I'm a New Yorker, so if I talk too fast, just slow me down. What we found in our investigation is that in their planning and decision-making to build Big Stone 2, the co-owners...
Excuse me, and I hate to throw you off right at the
sure.
beginning. We have had trouble with the internet picking up witnesses' mics, and you're coming through okay for this room, but if you just pull the mic a little bit closer,
okay.
I think that might help the people listening online. Thank you.
That's fine. No problem.
Thank you.
As I say, I'm a New Yorker, and sometimes I talk loud, and I hate to blow anybody's computer.
Loud is good with the folks listening on the internet. Thank you.
In their planning and decision-making to build Big Stone 2, the co-owners have assumed there will be no regulation of CO2 emissions during the plant's projected 40-year or longer operating life. However, CO2 regulation is not speculative, even though the timing and stringency of such regulations is uncertain at this time. The U.S. Congress has examined over the past few years and continues to examine numerous bills that would limit CO2 emissions. We at Synapse have developed, and we discuss in Joint Interveners Exhibit 1, a range of projected CO2 allowance costs from the years 2010 through 2030. Under the range of projected CO2 allowance costs, under our range of projected CO2 allowance costs, Big Stone 2 would incur annual penalties of between $35 million to $137 million each year on average, well, levelized. Despite uncertainties, the issue of CO2 regulations and their impact on the cost of operating Big Stone 2 must be addressed now before the plant is licensed and built. There is no economical control technology for CO2 emissions from pulverized coal plants. So this is not an issue that you can hope to deal with in the future. Allowing the plant to be built will be a commitment to 40 to 50 years of CO2 emissions. In the various pieces of testimony filed by the co-owners, there's been confusion between an externality and an internal cost of regulation. An externality is different from a regulatory cost. An externality is a cost caused but not borne by the producer of the cost. We have not considered externality costs in our testimony. We believe they need to be considered, but it's not an issue that we have projected. We have presented a range of projected direct costs of federal efforts to limit CO2 emissions. Although the co-owners have demonstrated that as a group they require additional capacity during peak demand hours starting in or about 2011, they have not shown that they need a 600-megawatt dispatchable unit. The co-owners have not shown that a portfolio of resources that includes renewables and demand-side management would not be more cost-effective than Big Stone 2. Now the co-owners are saying that in future years they will add some renewables and some DSM in addition to Big Stone 2. However, it appears that some of the wind resources that the co-owners say that they will add will not be added before the 2015 to 2020 time frame that Mr. Morlock testified to. That would be nearly a decade after Big Stone 2 would be built. Each of the Big Stone 2 co-owners is already heavily dependent upon coal. Adding Big Stone 2 would make them even more dependent. Despite their claimed plans to add wind, other renewables, and DSM, the co-owners will remain heavily dependent upon coal if they are allowed to build Big Stone 2 and natural gas-fired capacity, and thus will continue to be highly susceptible to costs resulting from federal regulation of greenhouse gases. Despite what the co-owners claim repeatedly in their testimony, we have not proposed that a gas plant be built in place of Big Stone 2. What we have done is to show that there are alternatives that are more economical than Big Stone 2. For the purposes of planning and deciding whether to build Big Stone 2, it is prudent to assume that at some time in the not-too-distant future, the federal government will take meaningful action to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases from power plants, that wind resources in South Dakota, Minnesota, and North Dakota will deserve a capacity credit of between 15% and 25% of their rated capacity, and that the wind production tax credit will continue to be renewed. I would make one last point that's not included here, is that our analysis of Big Stone 2 and CO2 emissions is from a point of view of economics. We also believe there are serious environmental issues related to global warming and climate change that our colleague Dr. Hausman presented in his testimony and that he would have explained had he been here today.
Thank you, Mr. Schlissel. We would now tender him for cross-examination.
Is it Mr. Glazer?
Yes, sir. I guess I'm excuse me, I'm up. Mr. Schlissel, good morning again.
Good morning, Mr. Glazer.
Let's start on page 18 of the first round of testimony, which is Joint Interveners Exhibit 1.
Page 18?
Page 18.
Thanks a lot. You have to get... falling apart in front of the commission here. I poured something on my...
That was just my first question.
What did I pour, or am I falling apart? May 19th, page 18?
May 19th, Exhibit 1, page 18.
Yes, sir.
And in particular, Table 3. Do you see Table 3 there?
Yes, sir.
And in Table 3, you present three carbon price forecasts, assuming that the country in the future adopts greenhouse gas regulations. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so what you're projecting in terms of future carbon dioxide costs is $7.80 to $30.50 is a range, and the mid case of what your projection is $19.10. Is that correct?
Well, those levelized costs over a period of years, you can see the price trajectories that underlie those levelized costs in Figure 1, which is directly above Table 3.
Right, that's correct, as the title to Table 3 indicates. And then if you would just turn the pages over to page 23, please. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, and I'm looking at Table 4, which is entitled CO2 Cost of New Fossil Fuel Resources. Do you see that?
Yes.
And in the column labeled Supercritical PC, I see, reading down the left side, that we have the three CO2 allowance prices there that you previously testified to just a moment ago. Do you see those, the 780, the 1910, and the 3050? You see that?
Yes.
Okay. And then below that, I see that those numbers have been converted into cost per megawatt hour. And if I'm reading the table correctly, what you're saying there is that just picking out one example, at the mid price of $19.10, that would project out to a cost per megawatt hour to Big Stone of $18.61. Is that correct?
Correct. But again, that's levelized cost.
Levelized
yes.
cost. Right. And then just reading down to line 10, you go on to say, from a purely qualitative standpoint, it is very difficult to imagine that other resources would not be more cost-effective than Big Stone 2 with the addition of $18.61 per megawatt hour in operating costs from our mid-case CO2 price forecast. You see that?
Yes.
Okay, and I want to explore, as we did in your deposition a couple of weeks ago, whether or not that statement that I just read applies not just to Big Stone 2, but in fact would apply to almost any comparably sized coal plant. And I wonder if it's fair to characterize your view as being one that you don't want to be tied down to any possibly proposed power plant. There could be individual circumstances, but that for most coal-fired power plants being proposed, it is hard to imagine that those plants would remain cost-effective as compared with other resource choices with an imputed carbon cost equal to $18.75 per megawatt hour. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it's close. My recollection was that that kind of cost would put a big hurt in the economics of proposed coal-fired plants, but you'd have to look at it case-by-case basis to determine whether there were or were not alternatives to each plant.
Do you have a copy of your deposition with you?
No.
I have one for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are not going to be introducing the deposition as an exhibit,
thanks.
But I will have a few questions off the transcript, and for those who would want a copy, we have extra copies to follow along.
Is there water in any of these pitchers? Thanks.
And while we're handing that out, so we can just keep moving along, I want to refer you to page 185.
185?
And beginning on line 3, my question was, I don't want to beat a dead horse on this, but you would expect that in most cases the kind of an $18% megawatt hour cost impact on a coal plant is going to result?
Yes.
Is going to result in that coal plant not being cost competitive against other resources, most cases, not all cases, question mark. And I believe your answer is, well, I don't want to beat a dead horse from my end, so I'm just going to say it would certainly put a hurt in the earnings and the economics of the power plant. But as to whether it would turn it around without knowing the specific circumstances, it's, we can't prejudge any other case. We haven't looked at the facts of any other case, but we are willing to say yes, it would put a hurt on them, on the economics, and it's difficult to imagine it wouldn't turn it around compared to other resources. And that was your answer then, and is that a fair characterization of your position?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, well, having made that statement, you would agree with me nevertheless that there are upward of about 100 proposed coal plants, 100 coal plants that have been proposed in the United States at this time?
I've seen numbers roughly 100, maybe a little higher in the media.
Okay. And all of those coal plants obviously would face the risk that at some point Congress would adopt future greenhouse gas regulation. Is that correct?
Yes.
And if we could just go to page 8 of your testimony, the same testimony.
Page 8?
Yeah, page 8 of the May 19th, Exhibit 1.
Yes.
And on line 21, the question is, do other utilities have opinions about whether and when a greenhouse gas regulation will come? And you answer yes, and you give a number of examples, but the first one is from James Rogers, the CEO of Duke Energy, who you indicate made the statement that he said there. Do you see that?
Yes.
Okay. You're aware, aren't you, though, that Duke Energy, in fact, itself has proposed two 800 for a total of 1,600 megawatts of supercritical pulverized coal plants at its Crossville location in the state of North Carolina?
Vaguely, I've heard that.
Okay. Mr. Hewson, at page 21 of his initial testimony, 9 to 11, indicates that in fact, is the case. Do you have any information that would contradict Mr. Hewson on that point?
No.
Okay. And you know that there are other coal plants in this region of the country that have been proposed? In this region, meaning the Midwest and Upper Midwest?
Oh, sure.
Sure. Basin Electric Power Cooperative has a proposed plant?
Yes.
Tri-State Generation and Transmission has a proposed plant. Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with the names of the plants through the owners. If you give me the name of the proposed project, that's what I usually look at.
Okay. Well, I don't know all the names. I know some of the utilities, but you're at least familiar with the Basin Electric plant.
Well, I'm familiar that there are a number of coal plants proposed for Wisconsin and West.
Okay. If we could go to page 13. Of the same testimony.
Yes.
And line 14, the question is, do any states require that utilities or default service suppliers evaluate costs or risks associated with greenhouse gas emissions in long-range planning or resource procurement? And I take it that that is what, in this case, you want the applicants to do, is to evaluate the costs or risks associated with greenhouse gas emissions in their resource procurement. Is that right?
Well, not. I believe they should have done it in the past and should continue doing it as things go forward. In this case, it's really a request for a permit before the South Dakota Commission. So I would ask not that the co-owners do anything, but that the commission consider this as part of their evaluation of the project.
Sure. And in doing so, obviously, to utilize the range of values, or at least the midpoint case of $19.10, is that right?
Yes and no. Yes, I believe they should look at a range of values, and I would not recommend that they just focus on the middle value. I think that it, given the uncertainty in future CO2 allowance prices, that it's important to look at a range rather than focusing on one price.
Okay. And then line 17 on page 13, you say, as shown in table 1 below, several states require companies under their jurisdiction to account for the emission of greenhouse gases in resource planning. And when we turn the page, there's table 1, and it lists states, the table is entitled Requirements for Consideration of Greenhouse Gas Emissions and Electric Resource Decisions. I see that some of these states are listed twice, and I counted, excuse me, 7 states that you listed here with these requirements, including but not including something called the NWPCC. That's the... what is the NWPCC?
I'd suggest that you hold these questions for Ms. Summer. She's more familiar with this area of the testimony than I.
Okay. I will do that. And then let's go to back to page 13. And in line 9, the question is, have any states adopted direct policies that require specific emission reductions from electric sources? And it lists 3 states. Do you see that there? Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Oregon, and California?
That's 4.
I'm sorry. Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Oregon. You're right.
I mean, I'm sure people think that states on the coast are the same, but...
Well, California, we have
there's
some...
There's 2 on each coast.
Okay. 4 states. Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Oregon, and California. I have some... Well, let me just ask you the questions. You tell me if I'm asking the right person. Do you know the... these are 4 states that, as the question indicates, actually require... their electric sources within the state to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions. Is that correct?
I believe so, yes.
And for these states, if I ask you the amount of coal that each state's electric generation, well, let me rephrase it. The amount of coal generation that each state has as a percentage of its total electric resource mix, would you know the answer to that?
I don't know percentages. I know I'm familiar with Massachusetts, partly because I live there and partly because we work there. Massachusetts has a fair amount of coal-fired generation. I think it's 5 or 6 units, 2 of which are very large. But I don't know as a percentage. It's not a very large percentage. But I don't know the exact percentage.
Mr. Hewson testified in his exhibit 30 that the percentages for each state were Massachusetts 25%, Oregon 7%. Do you have any information that would indicate that that is incorrect? for Massachusetts and Oregon?
No.
Okay. Do you know what the percentage is in South Dakota?
I don't recall it. No.
Okay. Mr. Houston, page 23, line 3, indicates that that amount is 46%. Would you dispute that amount?
No.
Do you know, comparatively, the retail electric rates of the four states listed here in comparison with South Dakota? Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Oregon, and California versus South Dakota?
I would imagine they're significantly higher, but there are lots of reasons for rate differentials.
Okay. You testify concerning the something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast, and that's on page 13, lines 4 and 5, and actually continuing down to 6 and 7. Do you see that?
Yes.
And the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is an initiative of a number of states in the Northeast to adopt a region-wide cap-and-trade program. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But that program actually has not been adopted by the individual states. Is that right?
That's a question. Again, it's called REGGIE. REGGIE's a question for Ms. Summer. She's more familiar with that than I. RGGI, I'm sorry.
Well, let's go back to page 18.
Of the same exhibit?
Of the same exhibit. And I'd like to inquire about figure one here, and I have a number of detailed questions about how to interpret and decipher this figure one. At your deposition, Ms. Summer was the one to whom you deferred on this figure. Should we do that here as well?
I can try my best shot. I understand how it's done and can explain it. If you want to try with me and then ask Ms. Summer, you may get a complete answer out of both of us. We may duplicate some.
Well, I think it's fair that we have one witness testify concerning this figure. I don't want to tag team this. I mean, if there's one of you who can answer comprehensively about this figure, I'd like to do it with one witness and save time and not have to do it with two.
We both worked on it. I think that's one of the reasons we presented panel testimony.
Well, okay. Then I will go forward at this time. Okay, it's fair to say just as a general matter here that the information on Figure 1 is designed to support the levelized carbon price forecasts that are shown on Table 3. Is that correct?
No, I wouldn't term it like that. No, it's not designed to support. This is the information we looked at when we developed the price trajectories that were translated into the levelized prices.
Right. Okay, that's a good correction. And so what we have on this figure one, we have these, and I guess we've put it up on this screen so others can look at it. It's important that as I go through this examination that everybody has a color copy, so we decided to put it on the screen in case people didn't have color copies. We have a series of geometrical shapes in different colors, and I take it each geometric shape that is represented on this figure represents a modeled forecast of carbon dioxide allowance prices under various proposals for greenhouse gas regulation. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And each color that we see here in the geometric shapes signifies a different proposal. So, for instance, let me just illustrate this. All of the blue circles, the blue triangles, the blue diamonds, is a bill that is, if you look at the legend in the upper left-hand corner, is S-138. Is that right? 139 it is. So each of the blue shapes is S-139. And then the difference here with the, some are circles, some are diamonds, some are triangles, as I said, the circles is a modeled forecast of the allowance prices of S-139 produced by an organization called TELUS. Is that right?
Yes, and the other two were produced by, the diamonds were produced by a study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and the triangles was are from a study produced by the U.S. DOE's Energy Information Administration, EIA.
Okay. Mr. Schlissel, can you keep talking to the microphone when you're looking up?
I'm sorry.
Okay, and so all of the blue, just to make this clear, it took me a while with this, all of the blue is a single bill, but the different shapes represent different model forecasts from different analytical entities. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Then, for instance, the green is something called EIA. I'm sorry. The green is all SA-2028. Is that right?
That's correct. There were two studies of Senate Amendment 2028, which was a variant of the Senate Bill 139.
Okay. Now, I guess the first thing that we can say about all of these proposals here that are depicted on Figure 1 is that none of them, in fact, were ever voted out of either the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives. That's correct, isn't it?
That's correct. The Congress has not voted out a greenhouse gas emissions bill.
But not just the Congress, either house of the Congress.
Okay, that's what I meant.
Okay. And let's start with the blue. The blue again is S-139, and as I understand it, S-139 is a bill that was introduced in early 2003 by Senators McCain and Lieberman. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that bill established a two-phase program for reducing carbon dioxide emissions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in phase one, it was one level of emission reductions required, and then there was a second phase in which even further emission reductions would be required.
Phase one was to bring emissions in 2010 back to the year 2000 levels, and phase two was to bring them back to 1990 levels.
Okay. Now the green geometric shapes, as we said earlier, that's SA-2028, correct?
Yes.
And SA-2028 was an amended bill introduced by Senators McCain and Lieberman later on in 2003. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And it's fair to say that the second bill depicted in the green, SA-2028, deleted, one of the things it did was to delete the second phase of reductions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so it is fair to say that the second proposal by Senators McCain and Lieberman was less stringent than the first proposal. Isn't that correct?
I think it's fair to say over the long term. Phase one was the same.
Okay. Now, the McCain-Lieberman bill was voted on by the Senate, was it not, in 2003?
Yes, it was defeated in 43 to 56, I think, was the vote.
Okay, and do you know whether the vote was taken on the bill as originally introduced earlier in the year or on the amendment that was introduced later in the year?
It was on the amendment S-2028.
Okay, so it's fair to say, looking at this figure, that all of the geometric shapes that are in blue represent a bill that was not only not voted on, it was replaced later in the year by the same sponsors with a bill that was less stringent. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, but the implication's not correct.
I'm not asking you about the implication. Your counsel will have an opportunity to redirect. I just want to get the facts out. Thank you. And even with respect to the green information on this figure, that represents a bill that, in fact, was voted on in the Senate, but was not adopted. That's correct.
That is correct.
Okay. Now, you're aware, aren't you, that Senators McCain and Lieberman then introduced another bill in 2005. Is that right?
That is correct.
And is it correct to say that the 2005 bill was similar to the Senate amendment version of the McCain-Lieberman bill in 2003 as opposed to the earlier version of the bill in 2003?
The answer is yes, with emphasis on the word similar.
Okay.
It was not the same.
Right. But the 2005 bill, like the second 2003 bill, only had one phase, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And it is also true that the McCain-Lieberman 2005 bill was voted on by the Senate. Is that correct?
Yes, as an amendment to the Energy Policy Act of 2005.
Correct. And it is also true that in 2005, this bill received even fewer votes than the the McCain-Lieberman bill that was voted on in 2003. Is that right?
It's true. That's why I mentioned the key word in your earlier question was similar. There were provisions that caused four of the Democrat senators who had voted in favor of the Senate Amendment 2028 in 2003 to switch their votes, and that was essentially the difference. Instead of 43-56, it was 38-60, I think. I think those are the numbers worked out.
Now, the orange on the chart indicates in the legend it says EIA cap and trade. You see that?
Yes.
And what is that?
Those deal with proposals by the National Commission on Energy Policy and studies of those proposals. Senator Bingaman, back in 2005, was in the process of developing a bill based on those proposals, and then after discussions with Senator Senator Domenici, he did not propose the bill at the time, and they've been in the process of, they've held some hearings, they're holding a series of meetings trying to develop details on how you would implement a greenhouse gas regulation, but from everything I hear is they still intend to submit a bill soon.
Well, just looking again at the orange, if you could turn to, you have an exhibit to your main exhibit. It's the Synapse Climate Change and Power, Carbon Dioxide, Emission Costs, and Electricity Resource Planning. And you know the document I'm referring to?
Yes.
Yeah. If you would turn to page 34 of that. Just off the record a second. You know, this was... Okay. And so, just for the record, we're looking at Joint Intervenors Exhibit 1, and behind that exhibit is a fairly lengthy report dated May 18th, 2006, with a title that I just provided for the record.
Counsel, I believe it's 1F.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. And on page 34, there's a figure. On page 34, there's a figure 6.2, and it describes the proposals for each of the colors on the figure that we've been talking about. And under orange, it says EIA analysis of cap and trade policies based on NCEP, but varying the carbon intensity reduction goals. You see that?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, so I take it here that an entity called NCEP, and you identified that as the National Commission on Energy Policy, was looking at a proposal, and that EIA did an analysis of that proposal, but varying some of the goals, the carbon reduction goals of that proposal. Is that right?
That's close, but I don't think it's completely correct, if I might.
Yeah, go ahead.
The National Commission on Energy Policy is a broadly based business, political, consumer, environmental group. Bipartisan, has heads of corporations, former political leaders. I have the report if you want me to read any more from it. The two studies, the yellow and the orange on the chart, figure one that's on the screen, are several different studies by EIA, Energy Information Administration, of the proposals that were presented by the NCEP in December 2004. The yellow proposal, I believe the yellow study was the EIA analysis of the NCEP proposals as they were made in December 2004. EIA was subsequently requested by several members of Congress to look at variations on the NCEP proposals.
Right.
So that's the orange. The yellow, I believe, is the NCEP as it proposed them, and the orange is as they were revised.
Okay.
Well, not revised, but examined under different intensity reductions.
And you mentioned Senator Bingaman. It's fair to say that Senator Bingaman floated a proposal during the energy policy debate in 2005 reflective of the NCEP report. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you don't think that was ever actually introduced on the floor of the Senate? Is it?
I believe it was not. I believe that he was going to introduce it, and after discussions with Senator Domenici, he decided not to. That's my understanding.
Okay. For the record, Mr. Hewson had testified that he thought that that the proposal actually had been introduced but then withdrawn, in the same understanding that you just described, but that's...
I checked the Library of Congress website this morning, and it didn't indicate that it had been developed, but we were probably quibbling over...
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, the question I really want to ask you is, there was actually legislative language that had been developed by Senator Bingaman at the time, isn't that correct?
I don't recall that.
Okay, but at least there was a specific proposal that was floated by Senator Bingaman, isn't that correct?
Well, yes, he was taking the proposals of the National Commission on Energy Policy and was going to submit them as legislation.
Okay. And so the Bingaman proposals that were being debated, or at least talked about, are represented on your figure one by the yellow. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. The orange is an EIA, a study of possible variations on that proposal, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so it's fair to say that the orange was never introduced as a bill. That's correct.
It has not yet been, no.
Yeah, the orange has not yet been. And as far as you know, the orange did not furnish the basis of the actual proposal that Senator Bingaman himself was working on.
That's correct. As far as I know, it was it.
Okay.
It didn't.
Now, in the yellow, we have yellow circles and yellow triangles. And so we have different estimates of what the this proposal that Senator Bingaman was working on, what they would result in terms of carbon price allowances. And is it fair to say that the difference in these estimates is largely due to whether or not you assume that there is going to be a cap, sometimes referred to as a safety valve, with respect to a maximum carbon price allowance, a carbon allowance price?
That's fair to say.
Yeah, so under the triangles, for instance, the yellow triangles here, what's indicated is the proposal that Bingaman was looking at, assuming that there was no cap, no safety valve price. Is that right?
The yellow triangles assume there was a cap, and the other figure assumes there wasn't. The higher figure assumes there was no cap.
Right. The higher figure assumes there was no cap.
Okay, then I misunderstood your question.
And the lower figure assumes there was a cap.
Yes.
Okay. And it's true, is it not, that the proposal that Senator Bingaman was circulating included a cap, correct?
Again, I don't know that he would drafted language. If what I do know is it was based on the National Commission proposals, which had a safety valve figure.
Okay, and what was that figure?
Somewhere in the order of $6 or $7 a ton.
Okay, so, and that is what is reflected in the lower, I guess I call them circles, I was incorrect, they're triangles, the lower yellow triangles, the ones that don't have the black outlining, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. We then have what I guess we are now calling the tan squares, with the black borders on them. Do you see those?
Yes.
Okay. And that's a proposal by Senator Jeffords, is that correct?
Yes.
The Jeffords bill actually never received a vote before the Senate, is that right?
That's correct. It's in committee, and in fact, he's in the process, of, according to the media, of drafting a new bill.
Okay.
But it's still alive in committee.
Sure, but the Jeffords bill that you're depicting here, in fact, never came out of committee, is that correct?
That's correct. It's still in committee.
It was never voted on in committee, is that correct?
I believe that's true, but I'm not positive.
Okay. And you indicate that he's working on another proposal?
Yes.
You are aware, being from where you live in your end of the world, that Senator Jeffords has announced his retirement from Congress?
Yes. But he doesn't retire till January 20th, I believe.
Right. You indicated that you thought that there was a, well, strike that. Let's turn to your second round of testimony.
dated May 26, 2006. Joint Intervenors Exhibit 4. No, I'm okay. And I thought we'd kind of cut to the chase here and go right to the end of the testimony to page 43 and 44.
Okay.
Okay. And then on line 20, you ask yourself, what is your overall recommendation to the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission? And you list three things, ending with the statement that the co-owners have not demonstrated that Big Stone 2 is the lowest cost option as compared to a portfolio of wind, other renewable, and demand-side alternatives. Do you see that?
That's correct.
But it is fair to characterize your position, is it not, that you do not have a specific recommendation to make to this commission as to the specific resources, the specific portfolio of wind, other renewable, and demand-side alternatives that you believe the co-owner should acquire as an alternative to Big Stone 2?
That's correct. We've not developed a portfolio.
Okay. And the testimony, Exhibit 4, examines potential scenarios of wind and gas generation. I'm referring to the tables that had the varying amounts of wind at the 800 and the 1,200 megawatt level and the varying amounts of gas. Do you recall that?
Yes, it's on, they're on page 17.
Okay. But my question is, you yourself are not actually recommending to this commission any kind of a wind-gas combination as an alternative to Big Stone 2. Is that right?
That's correct, as I think you and I discussed in the deposition, if I'm remembering correctly. I certainly think it would be something that the Big Stone owners would study in detail, but I'm not recommending a gas plant to be part of it, be part of the portfolio. Just it should be studied as part of the portfolio.
And it's fair to say that you yourself have not done sufficient study at this point to come up with such a plan or recommendation. Is that right?
Correct. So far, we've not done the detailed analysis that would be necessary for the development of a portfolio.
Thank you. Could we just go off the record for one moment, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
D-O... M-I-N-I-C-I. I'll look for that. Hold on. Geffords. G-E-F-F-O-R-D-S. Okay, let me.
The thing that your only review would be under.
Let me.
You should have approved this review.
There's Geffords.
Yeah, I would.
And the woman who actually typed this, I know she knows how to spell.
Are we back on the record?
Yes, thank you very much. We have no further questions for this witness.
Do you need a break, or do you want to forge ahead?
If this was a good time to break, I'd like a break if possible. If not, I'll forge.
It's as good as any. I mean, we've been going on a long time, but what do you think, commissioners? Do you want to? Okay. Take about 10 to 12 minutes. How about back at 10:02 by that clock on the wall? Thank you. Questions of Mr. Schlissel?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Schlissel, are you familiar with the South Dakota statutes governing this commission's authority over this kind of a proceeding?
Vaguely would be an accurate term.
Okay. If you look at your Exhibit 4, and I'm looking at the confidential version, but either version would contain this material. On page 43 and 44, you outline your recommendations to the commission. The second and third of those recommendations, well, the second is that the co-owners have not demonstrated they need 600 megawatts of additional baseload generating capacity. As I've looked through the burden of proof that the applicant has, I haven't seen that this is part of their burden of proof. Would you agree with that?
I had some discussions of the statutes with my clients back when we began this project in September and October, and I've not had discussions with them since then as to the various statutory requirements. I recall the testimony that the applicants filed. It might have been in Minnesota, or South Dakota. I remember that somewhere I saw various pieces, how the testimony fit in with the statutes, but I don't recall enough to feel comfortable giving you a statutory interpretation.
Certainly. No, I understand. In your testimony, you note that the economic benefits of Big Stone Unit 2 must be compared to alternatives. Did you mean must by any statutory authority, or must more in a appropriate perspective?
Must in terms of appropriate, prudent perspective.
Thank you. In your rebuttal testimony, page 5, line 22, and I'll take you a minute to get there. I'll give you a minute to get there.
Page 5, line 22?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yes.
Make sure that I'm there as well. You note that the rate increases would be lower under the wind alternative than they would be from the construction of Big Stone 2. Is that right?
Yes.
Have you given any thought as to why the applicants would be interested in building a higher cost generation resource?
I don't want to put words in their mouth, but it seems to me that they probably don't believe it's higher cost. On the other hand, it seems from what I've read is that they have the prejudices, and I don't mean that in any pejorative sense, towards building central station power plants. That's the kind of power plants that have been built. I mean, during Cross, one of the questions was about how the extent to which South Dakota is already dependent upon coal, and 46%. What we Synapse and a growing consensus is that what's needed is a change in the paradigm, that you have to, in order to address the threat posed by global climate change and in continued and increasing emissions of greenhouse gases, is that things that haven't been done in the past will have to be done in the future. So I think if you combine that together, but I don't believe from what I've read and from listening to the witnesses that any of them are sitting there thinking, boy, I want to build a more expensive power plant. I don't believe that at all.
Okay, thank you. You haven't offered yourself up as a coal expert, and so I understand that. So let me know if this is outside of your range of expertise. But in your testimony, you did note that you believe, and if you didn't say all, at least many of the co-applicants have an over-reliance on coal power for their generation sources. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
There has been some information entered into the record of this proceeding about the short-term fluctuations in coal price. For your preparation for this proceeding, did you come across any information about the longer term, the historical trends for coal prices?
Although it wasn't specifically preparation for this testimony, I spent a fair amount of time the fall of last year going into January of this year working on a project for the staff of the Arkansas Public Service Commission looking at the causes of the coal delivery problems that had been experienced. Entergy Arkansas was hit not only by higher natural gas prices, which have hit everybody, but also the coal delivery problems coming out of the Powder River Basin. And it seems that that's a concern for long term. The deliverability and price of coal out of Powder River Basin is something, is a risk. But other than that, I mean, I've seen some estimates of some cost increases in coal prices. But there's a lot of coal. But you got to balance that with the fact that if you're an energy company and you can sell natural gas at the prices that natural gas is fetching these days and projected, you'd want to raise the price you get for your coal. Just natural. But beyond that, I can't point you to any estimates of coal prices.
Thank you. Were you present during Mr. Wen's testimony?
No, I was not yesterday, but my clients told me some of it.
Did you have an opportunity to review his pre-filed testimony?
Oh, yes, I read his pre-filed testimony, his pre-filed rebuttal.
Mr. Wen had provided some information that some of the proposals set forth by you and Ms. Summers would mean that MDU would have far too much wind from an operational guideline perspective and from a integration standpoint. Did you have a reaction to those concerns by Mr. Wen?
Well, we understand and appreciate the concerns. We don't share them. We think that there needs to be an actual study of wind integration, not only on the MDU system, but for the region. MISO is in the process of attempting or working to consolidate control areas. If you look at the history of what's gone on in PJM to the east of MISO, consolidation is the name, is what happens. So that looking at a small isolated service area, and I don't mean to insult MDU by saying that, but a relatively small control area, we don't think is the way to go. We think that what you need to do is you can look at broader regions, because over time, those will be the balancing and control areas. So that while it may be a lot for MDU, if you look at them as an isolated system, they're not an isolated system. And then finally, just to get back to something I may not have said completely, you really need to do a wind integration study, which I understand MDU has not done, to figure out how much can we integrate, where can we integrate it, and what will it cost. And then you take those results and you balance that into, well, maybe it is too expensive to do a lot of the wind that we're talking about. Or maybe it isn't. We think from other studies we've seen that they can integrate it given the broader area, but you really need to do a detailed system study.
I'm asking this question from memory, so please correct me if I have any of the facts wrong, but I think in your testimony you cite a report by the Minnesota Department of Commerce and Xcel, the wind integration study they'd done, is that right?
For them, yes.
For them, okay. And did that find that a guideline of 25% was possible in that control area?
No. The various studies that have been done have shown that have been for up to 15 to 20% for a control area. But again, they're looking at a big control area, so 20% is a fairly substantial amount of wind. I understand that Minnesota is doing a very big study now, and the results will be done, I believe, by the end of the year.
Did you do, and I know that you and Ms. Summers are not, you know, putting forth a single recommendation as to what would be, what the co-applicant should do in lieu of Big Stone 2 if it were denied. But some of the proposals you evaluate, did you do any analysis on if that much wind was built on top of the wind that the applicants are individually looking to do? Did you do any analysis as to how much wind that would be for the control area? What percentage?
We did in our surrebuttal testimony, we gave an illustrative example that looked at MapUS, and that if you looked at 20% of MapUS, and we did the winter peak to be even more conservative. All the studies have looked at the annual peak, but we just chose winter peak. 20% of a projected peak load of roughly 27,000 megawatts, winter peak load for 2011 would be 20% is roughly 5,400 megawatts of wind. If you look at, the existing, the 800 megawatts that the co-owners say they're going to build, there's plenty of room for additional wind if you look at a broad enough area.
If you look at your rebuttal testimony, page 4, exhibit 5, page 4.
Yes, sir.
And the question on line 6 through 8 that was asked, is it reasonable for the South Dakota Commission to approve a permit for Big Stone 2 and hope to address these financial issues in subsequent rate cases for the plant's co-owners? In your answer, I think you say, well, only two of the utilities are rate regulated by the commission. For those utilities that aren't rate regulated by the commission, isn't that a risk that the member owners and of those utilities take when asking to construct Big Stone 2? Oh. I mean, and I'm not asking for a legal opinion here, but since it's offered in your testimony, I mean, is it the commission's place to try to make sure they make the most prudent decision for their member owners?
The answer is two answers. No, and you can't help it, because you do regulate two of the seven. I mean, conceivably, you could issue a permit for, well, it's not 5/7 because the two own more, but a portion of a plant. But I think that the ratepayers of the IOUs and the public utility partners are the same. The ratepayers of the investor-owned utilities have the benefit of having you folks to evaluate and to protect them. And I guess the public utility partners have the ability, the ratepayers have the ability to vote people out of office if the decision turns out badly.
What I'm asking, Mr. Schlissel, is that from time to time I feel as though the information we're being provided feels almost more like a certificate of need proceeding than perhaps a citing proceeding. Are you aware that, you know, commissions, you know, across the country and in fact this one have from time to time disallowed excess costs for generation plants that were not being fully utilized by the regulated utility?
Yes, I personally have won several cases in Texas and in Indiana where we showed that not only was there excess capacity, but it was excess capacity that the utility could have anticipated.
And you feel that those types of proceedings after the fact are not sufficient protection for ratepayers, given the financial risks possibly associated with Big Stone 2?
That's correct. I mean, let's use Mr. Glaze's example of an $18 and what was it, 61 cent per megawatt hour charge, additional charge levelized from our mid-case CO2 forecast, allowance forecast, price forecast. I mean, that's a lot of dollars. I mean, if Otter Tail or MDU came in and said, well, you know, we really didn't anticipate CO2 legislation, and you believe that they had, that's a big chunk of money to take out of the companies on a regular basis. So I don't know whether in reality you could do that without harming them financially, which of course you would have to consider.
Thank you. My final question, at some point, you know, this commission, you know, will have to make a determination whether or not we believe that the future costs of a carbon tax should be rolled into this analysis. Did you have any concerns that many of the points that were plotted on your chart, that many of those points were on pieces of legislation that did not appear to be politically viable, didn't appear to be gaining much political traction?
The answer is some. I mean, of course you are. I mean, it would be a better case, it'd be an easier case to come in here and say, well, Congress has passed the following three bills on global warming. But that's not the way the circumstances and politics, to be honest, are developing. That we chose the legislation that was presented up there in figure one, I think it was, of our exhibit one. We chose that legislation for a couple of reasons. One is because it was the most serious legislation getting extensive support from both sides of the aisle. We didn't want to pick a bill that would liberal Democrats or conservative Republicans either liked or hated. We wanted broad political support, and we wanted bills that had been analyzed, the cost impacts had been analyzed by the EIA, EPA, and other groups, so that we could come up with a range of potential cost impacts. The fact that these specific bills weren't viable does not dissuade us from the fact that something is going to happen. I mean, if Dr. Houseman had been here today, he would have talked to you about the fact that the scientific consensus is strengthening that there's a problem, that the evidence is there's increasing evidence that the bad effects are happening faster than anyone thought, and that the estimates of the cost consequences of the bad events from global climate change are increasing. In preparation for Mr. Glazer's cross today, I was looking at bills that are now before Congress. And there are a number of bills, but what really struck me, not the bills, and if you want, I'd be certainly happy to tell you some of them, but a quote from Senator McCain, who's running for president as a Republican, or it appears he's going to be running for president as a Republican. He said several weeks ago, the culmination of evidence is going to force us to act, Arizona Republican McCain said. The question is if we will act soon enough. And the Carper bill, which was one of the bills that Mr. Glazer and I discussed, it's been reintroduced and strengthened, now has four Republican co-sponsors, including someone who self-describes him as conservative Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. I was at a conference several weeks ago with a woman from Fitch's Ratings. She said she'd been at a luncheon with Graham, and that Graham is like a man possessed about global warming. He said he didn't believe it was happening until Katrina. And that Katrina led him to change his mind. So that while those bills may not be viable, there are other bills, and there will be more.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, that's all I have this time.
Commissioners? Mr. Hansen? Redirect?
You've answered my redirect.
You just did?
Yes.
Okay. Following up, do any of the other parties have questions in follow-up to the commissioner's questions?
We have no questions.
You may step down, Mr. Schlissel. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes.
I was talking to somebody, and she told me that she had heard.
Mr. O'Neill, were you going to move his summary, or is that a joint summary?
I was going to go.
It is a joint summary. We will now call Ms. Summer.
Okay. Thank you.
This is what I have to put up with every day.
Good morning, Ms. Paul. Go ahead.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony about giving this cause to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Good morning, Ms. Summer.
Good morning.
Ms. Summer, you were present for the testimony of Mr. Schlissel?
That's correct.
And what I'm going to do right now is direct your attention to the joint intervener exhibits, if you can have those in front of you.
Okay.
The first joint intervener's exhibit is Schlissel and Summer joint intervener exhibit number 1 from May 19, 2006. Do you have that in front of you?
I do.
Do you have any changes or corrections to that document?
I have a couple changes to one of the exhibits to this testimony, or one of the accompanying documents to this testimony. It's JI-1-F. It's entitled Climate Change and Power, Carbon Dioxide Emission Costs and Electricity Resource Planning. Sorry, Climate Change and Power, Carbon Dioxide Emissions Costs and Electricity Resource Planning. The first correction is on the executive summary. It's ES-III. In table ES-1, it says McCain-Lieberman SA 2028, and under the column entitled Year Proposed, the date should be 2003, not 2005. On page 12 of the same document, at the top of the page, there is a small box that's entitled Sense of the Senate Resolution, June 2005. In the first line of that resolution, before the end of the 109th Congress, should be eliminated, should be deleted. The next one is Table 5.1, page 33. I'm sorry, that's not page 33. That would be page 13.
Good eye.
Again, the same correction, McCain-Lieberman, essay 2028. In the column the year proposed, it should be changed from 2005 to 2003. And the last correction I have is on page 33. The text above the figure in this page says that figure 6.2 presents projected carbon allowance costs from the economy-wide and electric sector studies in constant $2,004. That should be $2,005. And it should be short tons, not metric ton. That's all I have for this piece of testimony.
If I asked you the same questions that you answered on joint intervener's exhibit number 1, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
We would offer into evidence joint intervener's exhibit number 1.
Is there objection?
No objection.
Intervener's exhibit 1, joint intervener's 1 is received.
Directing your attention to joint intervener's exhibit number 4, do you have that document in front of you? It is the confidential and public version of testimony from May 26, 2006?
Yes.
Do you have any changes or corrections to that testimony?
No, I do not.
If I asked you the same questions that were asked of you on that date, would your answers be the same as contained in that version?
Yes, they would.
We would offer into evidence joint intervener's exhibit number 4.
Objections?
Nope.
A joint intervener's 4 is received.
Having placed in front of you joint intervener's exhibit number 5, can you review that document and let me know if there are any changes or corrections to that exhibit?
No, I don't believe there are.
That is the rebuttal testimony of you and Mr. Schlissel from June 9th, 2006?
Yes.
If
I asked you the same questions that are asked of you in that exhibit, would your answers be the same?
They would.
We would offer into evidence joint interveners exhibit number 5.
Any objection?
No, sir.
Joint interveners 5 is received.
Next, place in front of you joint interveners exhibit number 6, the sir rebuttal testimony of you and Mr. Schlissel from June 22nd, 2006.
Okay.
Any changes or corrections to that testimony?
I have two corrections and typos. Let's see. They're on page 23. I'm looking at table 1. It's entitled Federal Regulation with Modeling Studies. The Clean Power Planning Act should be changed to the Clean Air Planning Act. And the Clear Power Act is actually the Clean Power Act.
Any other changes to that exhibit?
No.
If I asked you the same questions that were asked of you in that exhibit, would your answers be the same?
They would.
We would offer into evidence joint interveners exhibit number 6.
Objections?
No, sir.
Joint intervener 6 is received.
Ms. Summer, if you can place in front of you exhibit number 15, which is the PowerPoint presentation.
Okay.
Did you assist Mr. Schlissel in preparing that presentation?
I did.
This time we would offer into evidence exhibit number 15.
No objection.
Other parties? Joint interveners 15 is received.
Ms. Summer, now that the record contains all of the exhibits containing your testimony and exhibits, if you could provide for us a brief description of your educational background.
Sure. I was born and raised in Chadden, Nebraska. I attended college in Massachusetts and got a bachelor's of science in economics and environmental studies.
And can you tell us about your work-related experience that relates to your testimony here today?
Sure. While I was in college, I worked for an energy consulting company called EFI. EFI was acquired by what is now Kima Consulting, so I also worked for Kima Consulting for a time. I additionally worked for a wind energy development company called Horizon Wind Energy. And following graduation, I came to Synapse, and I've been there since 2003.
We would tender Ms. Summer for cross.
Applicants, please proceed.
Good morning, Ms. Summer.
Good morning.
Let's go to page 13 of Joint Interveners Exhibit 1. And I started off with Mr. Schlissel on this question. On line 14, the question inquires whether any states require that utilities or default electric service suppliers evaluate costs or risks associated with greenhouse gas emissions in long-range planning or resource procurement. And the answer is yes. And refers the reader to table 1 below, excuse me, and then table 1 lists the states that have such requirements. And again, I counted a total of 7 here, plus the NWPCC. And I think when I asked Mr. Schlissel the question, what is the NWPCC, he said, I should ask you.
Yes. The NWPCC is the Northwest, let me see if I can get this right, Northwest Power and Conservation Council.
Okay. And then I see at the top of the table, there's California. PUC requires that regulated utility IRPs include carbon adder of $8 per ton of CO2, escalating it at 5% per year. Do you see that?
Yes.
And so I had asked Mr. Schlissel whether in response to question 14, I'm sorry, the question beginning on line 14 on page 13, whether it was his and I guess your recommendation that in the instant case, present case here, these particular utilities, the Big Stone 2 applicants, should be required to evaluate costs or risks associated with greenhouse gas emissions in their Big Stone decision making. And what would your answer to that question be?
I would agree with Mr. Schlissel that since this is not a proceeding regarding integrated resource plans, it's really for the commission to decide whether that issue should be incorporated in a decision regarding a siting permit. We certainly think that it's prudent for integrated resource plans to consider CO2 regulation.
Okay, and at the present time, the California regulation provides a number, and that number is currently $8 per ton, as indicated on your table one. Is that right?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. It's a range of $8 to, I think, $25 per ton, and it doesn't represent regulation itself. It actually represents uncertainty associated with the cost of reducing CO2 emissions.
And then I think I went on and spoke with Mr. Schlissel about the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative.
Yes.
And that is an initiative of a number of northeastern states where they're looking at a prospective regional cap and trade program. You're familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
And the question that Mr. Schlissel referred to you is whether that regional greenhouse gas initiative had actually been promulgated into law by the various states that are a part of that initiative. Do you know the answer to that?
The way that REGGIE will work varies state by state. My understanding is that there is a memorandum of understanding between the various states in REGGIE that they will implement a regulation, but that regulation has not, you know, gone through the legislature or been implemented by the government or however it works in each individual state.
Okay, so the answer is that the REGGIE program, in fact, has not been adopted by any of these states, at least at this point?
No, but I think there is an expectation that it will be.
My question, again, is whether the REGGIE program at this point, in fact, has actually been adopted by any of those states, and I believe your answer to that is no.
No, because the timeline hasn't been reached.
Okay. That's fine. But still, at this point, none of those states has actually adopted this program.
No, they have not.
Okay. You're certain all of them are going to. Is that what you're saying?
No, if I sat here today and told you that anything that happens tomorrow is a 100% certainty, I would look like a fool.
Right.
But I'm saying to you that I'm quite certain that it will happen.
Sure. In fact, this REGGIE has been a long-term process. It's been going on for several years of planning. Is that right?
Yeah, a couple of years, yes.
Yeah, and I believe through most of the planning process, in fact, there were 9 states involved. Is that your understanding?
I don't recall the exact number.
Do you recall that Massachusetts was a part of the process at one point?
It was, yes.
And do you recall that Massachusetts elected to drop out of the process?
The governor elected to. The legislature is now considering a bill that would require Massachusetts to participate in REGGIE.
The governor declared that he was no longer participating in this process?
That's correct.
Okay. And you recall that the governor issued a press release indicating that the reason why he didn't want to participate in the process was because of economic impacts to the business community in Massachusetts?
Oh, yeah. I'm certainly aware of that.
Okay. Any other states drop out of the REGGIE process?
Rhode Island did. But then Maryland came on board, too.
So minus 2 plus 1?
Yeah, and possibly Pennsylvania as well. I'm not exactly sure about Pennsylvania.
Okay. But you don't know about Pennsylvania.
No, I'm not certain about Pennsylvania.
You're not here to tell us right now that Pennsylvania is joining the REGGIE process?
No, as I said, I can't speak to anything with 100% certainty.
In fact, what the Maryland legislature did was to enact legislation saying that Maryland should study entry into the REGGIE process.
I'm not sure. I know that they passed a bill that was related to REGGIE, and that the original bill would require participation in REGGIE if the governor did not do something to reduce CO2 emissions. I'm not sure what was ultimately passed by the legislature.
Okay, so you're not certain, in fact, whether or not Maryland did join the REGI process, for sure.
Well, as you pointed out, nobody has actually initiated regulations to join REGI.
Okay. And if I asked you for the states that are part of the REGI process, the amount of coal generation that each of those states use as a percentage of their total electric resource mix, would you know the answer to that?
No, I would not.
And Mr. Hewson, in Exhibit 30, page 26, offered testimony on this point. In footnote 14, where he said that the total coal use or the total coal generation in the REGI region accounted for only 15.3% of 2005 generation. So I take it you would not be able to dispute that?
Counsel, can she look at what you're looking
absolutely.
At?
Absolutely. I'm sorry. Would you like to have a copy of Mr. Houston's testimony in front of you?
Sure.
Do you have an extra copy there? Applicants Exhibit 30. Page 26, footnote 14 is what we're looking at. You can look at my copy, or if you have one, that's fine too.
What page is it again?
Applicants Exhibit 30, page 26, footnote 14.
Okay.
And my question simply is, you don't have information that would dispute what's depicted in, or the information is provided in footnote 14?
No, I do not.
And in the surrebuttal testimony that you and Mr. Schlissel provided in this case, which is Joint Intervenors Exhibit 6. You addressed Mr. Hewson's testimony regarding REGI. Is that correct?
Which page are you looking at?
I'm looking at the surrebuttal testimony, Exhibit 6, Joint Intervenors Exhibit 6, dated June 22, 2006.
Uh-huh.
And I'm asking you whether or not that testimony addressed Mr. Houston's testimony, Exhibit 30.
In part it did. Okay. I guess I'm wondering what specific portion you're talking about.
Well, let me ask this. If you go back to Mr. Houston's exhibit, Applicants Exhibit 30, on page 25?
Yes.
Mr. Hewson lists the projected CO2 allowance prices that would result if the REGI program, in fact, is adopted by the REGI states, and those prices begin in 2009 at $1 a ton and escalate to 2024 by $2.62 a ton. And my question is, in looking at your surrebuttal testimony, Joint Intervenor Exhibit 6, I didn't see anything in that surrebuttal testimony that disputed the allowance prices that Mr. Hewson had provided here. Am I correct in my reading of your surrebuttal testimony that you, in fact, did not dispute the allowance prices set forth by Mr. Hewson?
Well, you're partially correct. I mean, we didn't dispute the prices, but we disputed the conclusion.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the conclusion. I'm just talking about what the allowance prices projected from compliance with REGI would be. Your surrebuttal testimony did not dispute those prices.
No, I've seen these prices before, too.
Okay.
That's all the questions that I have.
Ms. Stevie? Staff?
Good morning.
Good morning.
On Exhibit 1, page 15, and I'd asked the previous witness about this table, and he said to defer it to you.
Okay.
Are you at that page then?
I am.
Okay. Do you know why do these utilities use CO2 adders? Is it because they're required to?
I don't recall specifically the reason for all of these. PacifiCorp, I believe, is required to. I don't think that the requirement states what range that they should use, though, so they selected the range on their own. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council is a quasi-government agency, so I don't imagine that there's any specific government regulation that would require them to do so. As to the others, I'm not entirely sure. As I said, it's been a long time since I've reviewed these specific companies.
So you couldn't point to any one of them other than, I think you said, PacifiCorp. The rest of them, you just don't know if it's on their own initiative or if they're required.
Yeah, now without going back and looking, I wouldn't know for sure.
And then looking at, for example, Idaho Power, which has a range between $0 and $61. Do you see that?
Yes.
How do these utilities deal with that range?
I don't recall specifically regarding Idaho Power. I can speak to PacifiCorp, which has a similar range, if that's helpful.
Okay, sure.
I don't believe there's any specific document that underlies the range. The PacifiCorp seemed to start from the assumption that there would be regulation of carbon dioxide at some point in the future, and they applied a probability to that regulation in, I think, starting in 2008. I don't recall exactly when. They applied that probability to each number within that range from 0 to 55. And their base case was not 0. It was, I believe, $8 per ton.
So if when they decide to build a coal-fired plant and there's that range, do they use one end or the other or something in between? I mean, do you have any idea?
Well, to my knowledge, PacifiCorp is not proposing to build a coal-fired power plant. So I can't.
Right, but Idaho Power, you don't know. And you don't know.
Idaho Power is not proposing to build a coal-fired power plant either.
All right, thank you.
Commissioners, do you have questions? Commissioner Sauer?
No, thank you.
Is there a redirect?
Yes.
Ms. Summer, you've received some questions here on cross and from staff in regard to state regulations and in regard to REGI. Before I get into specifics, what relevance do you put on other state regulations and REGI as it relates to this process of evaluating CO2 regulatory costs?
Well, our allowance price forecast is a forecast of federal regulation. So the state level examples are simply to show that this is not out of the ordinary, that other people are considering CO2 regulation.
As it relates to REGI, are there some program structure assumptions that are important in understanding what REGI is going to do?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the page of Mr. Houston's testimony that Mr. Glazer was referring to, it's page 25, and he's talking about this range of allowance prices from $1 to $2.62 per ton. The reason it's so low is because REGI is a regional program. That means that the REGI states will still be able to import power that will presumably be lower cost because they're not subject to the CO2 regulation. When ICF did ICF is the consulting company that did the modeling runs that determine these allowance prices. So when ICF did this modeling, they also did a kind of sensitivity in which they imposed national regulation that was less stringent than REGI, and the allowance prices went up to, I believe, around $12 per ton.
Thank you. That's all the redirect type.
Are you still talking about it?
There was one question that I did forget to ask that arose from Mr. Schlissel's testimony. You heard him testify regarding Duke Power and the situation involved with Duke Power. Do you have an ability to testify regarding the status of what Duke is doing?
I'm going to object to that. It's beyond the scope of my cross-examination. I didn't ask this witness a single question about Duke.
I'm going to let her answer because of the question in the other proceeding.
I assume you're referring to the proposal that Mr. Glazer was saying that he thought that Duke Power was going to build two power plants, or he was saying that Mr. Houston had said that?
The question and answer between Mr. Glazer and Mr. Schlissel, yes.
Well, I guess I have a different understanding than Mr. Houston. A press release on the Duke Power website said that they're building a pulverized coal plant to replace an existing pulverized coal plant of approximately the same size, and that they might build a second plant in the future. I don't know if that will be a pulverized coal plant or an IGCC plant or not. And as many people in this room probably know, Jim Rogers, who is now CEO of Duke Energy, until recently was CEO of Synergy, which is an Indiana-based utility. And Synergy is not building pulverized coal. They want to build an IGCC plant because of CO2 regulation.
That's all the redirect I have.
Do you have any follow-up questions, Mr. Glazer, since I allowed him to open up what was really a direct examination?
Okay, yes, actually I do. Your knowledge of the Duke coal plant proposal is limited to reading the press release?
Yes, it is.
You're not familiar with whether or not Duke, in fact, has filed an application with the North Carolina Public Utility Commission for a permit to construct two 800 megawatt supercritical pulverized coal plants?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So I take it the bottom line on REGI then is we have a group of northeastern states that don't utilize a lot of coal anyway, and they've come up with a program to do something about CO2 emissions, which in your view is not going to cost very much, principally because it's not going to be very effective, because they're just going to import power, and it's likely to be coal power from out of the region anyway. Is that where you're coming out on the REGI process?
No, what I'm talking about is the modeling that ICF did, and ICF showed that it seemed likely that there would be imports of power from other regions because of REGI. I don't have any idea in practice how that will work. I don't know if REGI will expand beyond the existing states. It could certainly be different in the future.
And if the imported power comes, for instance, from the Midwest, it's going to be coal power?
Yes.
So in essence, they're displacing their greenhouse gas emissions to the Midwest?
Yeah, I think you know, if that is the case, it indicates that federal regulation is preferable.
But it doesn't allow anybody to hold up the REGI process as an indication that at least people in the Northeast are really getting serious about greenhouse gas regulation, and therefore other people ought to get serious about it also.
No, I don't think you can conclude that, because the problem of leakage is one of interstate commerce. It's essentially out of their control. The REGI states are certainly struggling with that issue, and they would very much like to address it, but they have not found a way to address it as of yet.
I have no more questions.
Thank you. Any last commissioner questions?
I have none.
You may step down, Ms. Summers. Mr. O'Neill?
We have no further witnesses.
Okay. Thank you. Do the applicants, are you going to put on a rebuttal case?
Mr. Smith, sorry to interject, but it is probably worth deferring to staff to see if they had anything additional since they didn't go out of order.
Excuse me, you're right. You're right.
Since we forced them to go out of order, it's perhaps more accurate.
No, staff, I talked to Dr. Denny, and she had not heard anything that would change her recommendation. Thank you.
And thank you for agreeing to go out of order.
Mm-hmm. That's not easy. Am I addressing you at this point, Mr. Welk?
No, I just thought of another housekeeping once we get through the procedural aspects of everybody resting their cases.
Okay, let me first of all ask applicants whether you have a rebuttal case.
We have no case, no rebuttal case.
Okay.
we have no rebuttal case. Did everybody get that?
We got that.
I'll say it one more time if you didn't get it.
Ms. Stevie had approached me a while ago and has an issue regarding a exhibit that she would like to tender, and staff has a housekeeping measure as well. Ms. Stevie, should we start with you? This involves a document that was requested by, I believe, Commissioner Hansen as a follow-up to the Milbank, during the Milbank hearing. And Ms. Stevie's concern was that she could not find it on our website or in the Milbank hearing record, apparently. And I've looked at my list of documents, and I can't see it on there either. So I can only suspect that maybe that's because it went directly to Commissioner Hansen or something. At any rate, Ms. Stevie, do you want to describe what you're talking about and what you'd like to do? Oh, pardon me?
Todd Guerrero, for the record. I know what document she's referring to, and I don't have it here. It's not part of our case.
I have also offered it as Stevie Exhibit 1G.
We have it here. It's not been marked as part of any of our exhibits. It's not part of our case. If the question is whether or not we would stipulate to its admissibility in this case.
Yeah. Well,
either that or she would maybe try to lay a foundation and offer it. That would be...
I guess I would prefer that we do that.
Okay. I haven't even seen it, so I don't know what we're talking about.
I can pass around copies. I do have copies. I'll pass these around.
Mr. Smith, we'll stipulate to its admissibility, and she can mark it however she wants to mark it.
Do you want to mark it Stevie 1G?
It is marked Stevie Exhibit 1G, yes.
Okay.
I think you should identify it for the record. What it is, Ms. Stevie.
It is Stevie Exhibit 1G, and it came as part of the discovery process. I believe at the Milbank hearing, Commissioner Johnson, I believe, made a request following the PowerPoint presentation that showed a diagram, something such as this, on the SOX emissions.
The court reporter can't take down what you're showing, so just
okay.
If you just explain, I think there's a cover letter for Mr. Madsen, and just describe the letter and the date and then whatever was appended to that will be sufficient, I think.
Okay, it is the document number, discovery request document number, Bates stamp number, JC00001728. And it is a letter to Ms. Bonrud, Executive Director of the Public Utilities Commission, in this matter.
Let me see if I can help, if you don't mind, Ms. Stevie. The document that's being marked as Stevie Exhibit 1G, in addition to the cover letter from the Boyce Greenfield Law Firm, is a document that was prepared by Otter Tail and presented at a public hearing by Otter Tail on September 13, 2005 in Milbank, South Dakota. Will that do it? Which applicants stipulate to its admissibility.
Excuse me, Mr. Smith?
Yes.
I just would, I believe that some of it was perhaps presented at that Milbank hearing, but that the request that this responds to was to provide additional information that wasn't at the hearing. So I just wanted to make that clear.
That is correct. And are we okay? And I'm, unless there's an objection, there's been a stipulation from between applicants and Ms. Stevie. Hearing no objection, Stevie 1G is admitted. And the one last request we've had involves a document that was marked yesterday as applicants 117. Do you have that? Or was it, was it actually marked or was it just a reservation? Oh, wait, that's not one. Let me see that. I might have the wrong number.
For Lancaster.
Mr. Smith, I think there's two different, we're talking two different.
The one, maybe I'm wrong here. I thought 116 I have as Lancaster affidavit and 117 yep. I show as 117 is the U.S. EPA. That was admitted, correct?
Yes. Mr. Lancaster's affidavit, similar to Dr. Hausman's, number was reserved, and I'd like that was the housekeeping matter I had. So we don't create a rush of emails and letters. Can we just stipulate, similar to Dr. Hausman, that when that affidavit comes in, assuming it's a similar format, it's deemed admitted?
Is that acceptable? Thank you. So it is so done, and we'll consider that admitted. I guess I had thought, and I think I got confused here, that the document that staff would like to offer is the document, the toll document that was referenced yesterday in connection. It's one of the foundational documents for the literature survey that I'm sorry, I don't have my glasses, and you're going to have to
look. Karen, is that the 2005 article that you referenced?
Yes, it's the one that Commissioner Johnson, it's actually, it says June 5th, 2004. It's the one Commissioner Johnson asked for the underlying, and it's that article.
I have a question on that. When you asked for the reference on that, what was it in regards to? Was it in regards to the air deposition locally, globally? Was that another housekeeping matter?
This was Dr. Denny had done some literature review. And this was an article that she did not refer to in her testimony, but not in her pre-filed testimony, but in her verbal testimony, oral testimony, she did mention that.
Okay.
Karen, what are we marking that as? When it comes around, we'll give it to the court reporter.
Staff Exhibit 4.
So we do have one more housekeeping matter.
Well, let's take care of this one first.
Okay.
So staff would so move to have Exhibit 4 admitted.
No objection.
No objection.
And staff 4 is admitted. Okay, Ms. Stevie, now what's your issue?
Yesterday, staff asked for the foundation report from witness testimony over the course of the week that had accrued about, and for example, I believe it's listed in one place, the pre-filed rebuttal of Terry Grauman, Exhibit 34, but it was the last witness yesterday for the applicants that referred about attributable hotspots. So where are we, the question was, so where are we looking at this occurring locally, globally? And you asked where you could find the report. You hadn't been able to access it, that 70 Fed Reg 15994, the March 29th, 2005, and one gentleman was going to provide it this morning to enter it in to evidence.
I believe the document that she's referring to is one that Terry Grauman of Otter Tail was going to locate and provide to Ms. Kramer. Is that the one you're referring to?
It was a witness yesterday that you asked, requested if he could bring it in.
Okay, I don't remember that. I do remember asking Terry Grauman on that federal site.
And we've got that.
Okay, but I don't remember asking anyone at the end of the day or any...
It was brought up again in his, in the cross.
I vaguely recall that something with a witness yesterday was an EPA report that was requested, but I don't remember more than that at the moment, so maybe we could check the transcript.
Is that what this is?
Yes.
Okay.
Is it coming around?
Do you want me... I assume that, do you want it handed to the commission? It was for you, your request, so that's why it hasn't been marked.
Yes, thank you. If you, do you want to just send those extra ones down here and we'll mark that?
You want it marked, Karen?
So is this part of the evidence?
Is it now? No, I mean it's an official. It's on apparently on the, as I recall, it was on the EPA website. My recollection is he was going to provide a URL, but you know, here it is. So
I would offer staff's Exhibit 5. It is a statistical analysis of mercury test data to determine if BDT, boys, David, Tom, for mercury emissions.
Is there an objection from anyone?
No objection from the applicants.
I do object.
And your objection, please state it.
My objection would be that this report predates more recent report, Stevie Exhibit 1E, that challenges said findings in Staff Exhibit 5.
Any response?
I would just suggest that the commission can give the weight to those exhibits as they so choose.
The objection's overruled and staff's Exhibit 5 is received.
Could I move a Stevie Exhibit 1E into evidence? It's only in under judicial...
That is evidence.
It is evidence?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yep. Is there anything else? Does anyone have anything else from an evidentiary standpoint? Let me put it that way.
And nothing from the applicants.
Ms. Stevie?
Nothing.
Joint interveners? Staff? Okay, that concludes the evidentiary portion of the hearing. I guess, are there any other, you know, we have the remaining events, the ones that I know of are set forth in the third and fourth scheduling orders. The first of which occurs this evening at 7 o'clock, and that would be the public comment, public testimony, I guess it really is. It's actually testimony. I think the next date we have is, and I'm going purely from recollection, is July 9th, which is the deadline for filing of proposed findings, conclusions, and briefs. And then we have July 11th, which is oral argument, and we have scheduled at least July 14th for final decision for the commission to make their ruling, with the order to be issued on or before July 21st. Are there any other housekeeping or administrative matters that we need to resolve before we adjourn?
Is July 9th Sunday?
It is.
And did we? I think we consciously made that decision, even though it's out of the ordinary.
We did.
All right. That's
we did, and we provided some special
arrangements,
exemptions from paper service, et cetera, because of that.
Thank you. We have nothing further from the applicants, Mr. Smith. And thank you to all the parties and the commissioners and all the staff for the courtesies that have been extended to us through this week.
You're welcome. And I think what we'll do then is we'll recess the hearing until 7 o'clock this evening. And certainly hope that many of you can be there. Thank you.